Well, the title of my sermon is The Reason We Worship. Why is it that we worship? I think it's an important title, or an important topic to discuss. It's not one that I've heard very often, at least. There's certainly aspects of this that I've heard many times. But there's things in here that I think are very important. And as I was going through, I started in one text in the Old Testament. I was gonna preach out of Elijah and something out of his story. I didn't know what, and I just read and I prayed about it, and I ended up going from there to a different passage, and from there to a different passage, and from there to a different passage, and eventually I just found a passage, and I just felt absolutely comfortable with it, and I'm convinced that this is a message that we all need to hear. I am convinced that one of the primary reasons for the lack of true worship in many, if not most, evangelical churches today is a result of improper motivation. We all know that we are supposed to worship, but many of us don't really know why we're supposed to worship. Without knowing and comprehending why we should worship while we are worshiping, I fear that the result of our worship is in vain. Just as if I told you to dig a hole in the ground, but I didn't tell you why I wanted you to dig it, the chances are pretty good that the hole that you would end up digging wouldn't serve the purposes that I had originally hoped it would serve. You may dig, a small skinny hole like this deep, for a post, but say I wanted a hole for a foundation of a house. If you didn't know the reason why you were digging a hole, it really wouldn't work that well. It wouldn't be as functional. It wouldn't be done in the right way. It wouldn't be as good. Another analogy that I have, I guess, for understanding the motivations of why you do things, and if you have proper motivations for doing something, you're going to do it better than if you didn't know the reason why you're supposed to do something. Most people are very familiar with 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and 1 Corinthians chapter 13, although most people that I talk to, at least in my circles, aren't exactly convinced that they're not very familiar with the fact that these two chapters are completely intertwined together. 1 Corinthians 12 is, the spiritual gifts chapter. If you want to talk about spiritual gifts, you go to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and it goes and it lists all the different spiritual gifts that you could have. Speaking in tongues, interpretation of tongues, discernment on all these various gifts, and it's a chapter that most people are familiar with, and they know where it is for the most part. And they like it a lot. You go on 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Most people know that chapter too. That chapter is love is patient, love is kind, love does not envy, love does not boast. It's the love chapter. If you ask anyone where the love chapter is, if they were brought up in evangelical churches, they pretty much know that that's 1 Corinthians chapter 13. However, I think that it's very important, very very important, that people realize about chapter 13. The love chapter, is that the reason that Paul wrote that chapter was to give the motivation for using the spiritual gifts. He says, these are all the spiritual gifts. And then he goes on and says, if you don't use these spiritual gifts in love, you're using them in vain. He's saying, if you don't speak in tongues in love, you're using them in vain. If you're not gracious in love, you're doing it in vain. You could go through every single spiritual gift. If you're not doing it in love, it's in vain. It's the motivation that's very, very important. You could use your spiritual gifts just because God commanded you to use them, but it would be very easy for us to use those gifts in a sinful way. If you were a wealthy individual, you had the spiritual gift of generosity, and you used your spiritual gift of generosity at a motivation for getting a tax break, or so people would recognize that, you're giving this foundation all this money. Look at me, I'm writing this check. It's very easy to use your gifts in a selfish way and in a prideful way. That's why Paul goes on, and he's very, very, very clear in chapter 13 that you have to use your spiritual gifts in love. The motivation is very, very important in how you do things. It plays a very important role. If the Good Samaritan was walking down the road and he sees this guy who's all beat up on the side of the road, and he decides to help him out so that people will think he's a good guy, and he's still doing the guy a favor, but it's not as good as if he would just help him out based on the motivation of compassion and love. Your heart should go out to this person in love and compassion, and that should be your motivation for doing these things. And so I ask the question tonight, what should be our motivation for worship? Because if we have the wrong motivation in mind when we worship, there's a good chance that our worship is either in vain or it's not producing the effect that God had intended for it when He ordained worship. I think that worship services in churches, in many churches today, are like a merry-go-round. And this is a quotation, by the way, by John MacArthur. Worship services in many churches today are like a merry-go-round. You drop a token in the collection box and it's good for a ride. There's music and there's lots of motion up and down. The ride is carefully timed and seldom varies in length. Lots of good feelings are generated, and it is the one ride that you can be sure will never be the least bit threatening or challenging. But though you spend the whole time feeling as if you're moving forward, you get off exactly where you got on. And I thought that was really interesting. I spent a good deal of time discussing with friends of mine the various problems in churches. Seems to be a popular topic of mine, I guess, in conversation. I tend to see in churches that I've attended in the past, you know, many problems. And that's not necessarily a good thing, I suppose. I've been trained to be an evangelical pessimist, I suppose. But I do agree with this assessment, and I think that a lot of churches don't have it right, and a lot of churches have the wrong motivation for worship. And I think that the motivation for worship is actually one of the things that is key to worshiping correctly or worshiping properly, or getting all out of worship what God had intended. So, I made up a little list of some reasons why we should not worship, or not good reasons why we should worship, and also the reason that I'm proposing why we should worship. These are not a reason not to worship. One reason we do not worship is to present God with our offerings of praise as though He needed them. God does not need our praise. God does not need us at all in any way. He created us, but He doesn't need us. He's completely sufficient in and of Himself without us. We should not worship. Our motivation to worship should not be to charismatically demonstrate to God or others what good Christians we are. Or you can take charismatically out of that, if you will, just to demonstrate to God or others what good Christians we are. That's not the reason that we are to worship. That's a selfish motive. Worship is not about us or our good deeds. For we are Christians because we know we are sinners, not because we think we are good people in any respect. God, excuse me, I'm getting over a lung infection, so I got a bunch of crud in my lungs. Still, I apologize. Another motivation, another reason we should not worship, is to seek any sort of favor of God based on the merit of our worship. In many religions, if not most religions, I think today, or even in past in history, a lot of the reasons that people would go to worship, you know, would be to appease the gods. You know, I know that the Incas or the Mayas, one of the South American people, I don't know, down there, they used to always kill people, you know, on those ziggurats. I think they're called ziggurats. They would do human sacrifices in order to prevent the end of the world. You know, appease the god with all this blood, and hopefully he'll prevent the end of the world. And I mean, most religions, if you really think about it, the motivation behind their worship, they go to worship to appease the god or to find favor in the eyes of that particular god. If you look at the story of Elijah, which I read a lot this week, beginning of this week at least, you know, the prophets of Baal, the 450 prophets of Baal, were running around and dancing and cutting themselves, saying, "Baal, Baal, come, please light the fire on this, you know, on this pyre. You know, come light it." You know, they're begging for Baal to look down on them with favor, and that was the reason for their worship, was so that, you know, they would seek merit in the eyes of their god. And that is not the reason that we as Christians should worship. I mean, it is not the primary reason at all. Any merit that we have in the eyes of God, any merit that we do have in the eyes of God, is based upon what He has done for us, and not what we have done for Him. And not what we have done or can do for Him, I should say. And again, I must reiterate that God does not need us. We're not essential for God. He desires to be with us and He loves us, but He does not need us. Another reason why we should not worship, this is not a reason why we should worship, I should say, is in order that we might receive uplifting emotions. We should not be seeking emotionalism You should not go to worship with the desire of worship makes me feel good. You know? That shouldn't be why, because that's about us. That's self-centered. You know, the reason that we go to worship should not be to make ourselves feel good. Yeah, emotions can and often do happen in worship. They're not always good emotions, and I would even go so far as to say that if all you experience in worship is good emotions, then you're not experiencing worship. You're experiencing something else, but it's not worship. I think that when we worship properly, we should not feel like we're better people for it. Rather, we should feel the pains of conviction and the knowledge of God, the knowledge that God has forgiven us even though we are unworthy. And I think that's one of the reasons that our service is set up the way it is. We go through the law. We read from the law. I think these are the things that God has required of us. And almost every single week when I'm sitting here listening to Doug read the law, you know, I feel convicted by that because there's so many things in there that I have not done, I have failed to do. And I know that even if I tried my best and my hardest all the time, I would still fail to do them. And I feel convicted by it. And then we move on in our service to the confession, you know, confession, a time of public confession. Because we're confessing to God that, you know, we're horrible people, we're sinners. If you don't realize that you're a sinner in your worship, then I don't know that you're really worshiping, because that's part of worship, is understanding the proper relationship between you and God. I think that understanding has a lot more to do with it than people give credit for. Another reason, that was the last one that I had listed here. There's lots of reasons why we shouldn't worship. But the one reason that I came up with that I think should be our primary motivation every time we come together and worship God, and actually every time we worship God anytime, is simply gratitude. I think that gratitude should be the reason that we worship. We should be grateful for what God has done for us. And thinking and dwelling upon that should be our primary motivation when we worship. And in order to understand what God has done for us, and in order to have this gratitude, you need to have a proper understanding of who God is, what God has done, who we are, and who we are in relationship to God. Because you can't understand what God has done for you if you don't understand how sinful you were, you know. The older I get, and the wiser I get, hopefully, at least, I think I'm getting wiser. The wiser I get, the more I realize how sinful I am. I realize that I realize more and more how sinful I am. I'm not getting more sinful, but I'm realizing more and more how sinful I am. But the more that I realize how sinful I am, the more I realize how much God has done for me. Because the greater I understand the debt that I owe Him, and I'm sure that it's far greater than what I comprehend it now, the greater I understand that debt to be, you know, he paid that off. And so the greater the grace is that has been bestowed upon me that I understand. And I still don't fathom the depths of it. And I don't know that I ever will, but that's part of the Christian walk. It's part of sanctification. That's what we're called to do. So I think that a proper understanding is definitely in order for us to have gratitude. And the greater our understanding of who God is and who we are and who we are in relationship to God, the greater our gratitude will be for Him. And I believe that if we have a proper understanding of gratitude, and if we actually have gratitude, if we have a proper understanding of God, we will be compelled to have gratitude. And if we have gratitude, I believe that we will be compelled to worship. A man by the name of Kelly Sparks, I have no idea who he is, said this. He says, God is not moved or impressed with our worship until our hearts are moved and impressed by Him. And so what about God does? It's all about what God does for us and us realizing that. It's not about what we do for Him. That's what compels us to worship. Some of you may say, well, I've always heard that we're supposed to worship because we're commanded to worship. You know, God commands us to worship Him. And you know, that's very true. That's absolutely true. And I'm not denying that whatsoever. However, yes, we worship Him because we're commanded to do so, yet our obedience to Him in all things, especially worship, should be motivated in pure gratitude for what He's done for us. So I would say that even motivation would be a more basic way to describe the command. I mean, gratitude is a motivation for us to obey. I believe. I mean, and obeying, I believe, is also a form of worship. I'm not limiting worship to just, you know, singing songs. I'm not limiting worship to just church service, listening to a sermon. I think, you know, worship as a whole lifestyle. You know, I think that gratitude should be our primary motivation. So all worship should be motivated in gratitude of what God has done for us. Therefore, the question must be asked: what has God done for us? And understanding that is the key to understanding why we should worship, I believe. So, this question is often overlooked by modern evangelicals today. Rather, we prefer to look at ourselves with the premonition of seeking to find what merit may be found in ourselves. We ought rather to be diligently applying ourselves to the study and further understanding of exactly what it is that God has done for us. So that's what we're going to do through the rest of the remainder of this of my time here. I'm going to share a little bit about what has God done for us. And I know that this may be reviewed a lot of you guys, but this is just it's the heart and the soul of the gospel for me, and I just love this stuff. And the deeper my understanding of this is, the deeper my understanding of God is, and the deeper my understanding of God is, the deeper my understanding, the more I feel compelled to worship, I should say, as a result of that. So I'm going to spend the majority of the rest of the time in our primary text tonight, which is in Romans 8, verses 28 and 29. It's a very popular passage that many, many pastors have preached on many, many times, and I'm sure most of you are very familiar with it. However, I think that this is a very important list to understand, because if you're going to be asking the question, what has God done for us, this is a list that Paul has given us. These are things that God has done for us. This is often referred to as the five golden links. These are five things that God has done for us as Christians, and they're things that we ought to know and understand very well. Starting in verse 28, it says, "And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. For whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, that He might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom He predestined, these He also called. Whom He called, these He also justified. And whom He justified, these He also glorified." One of the reasons that I picked this passage is because I think that parts of this passage are often misunderstood a lot. And I have spent quite a good deal of time studying passages, this passage and several other passages having to do with predestination. And so this, I think that a lot of my time spent arguing with friends of mine and debating and researching has led me to this verse and given me a little bit more background in order to be able to understand this a little bit better. So hopefully I can be able to share some of that with you. I wanted to look at the word foreknew, because I think that is one of the most misunderstood words in this passage. It says, "For whom He foreknew, He also predestined." So who did He foreknow? I mean, it's just a question that many people have problems with. Foreknowledge, I mean, the Greek for the word is prognosko. It's a prefix pro, meaning before, gnosko, basically meaning knowledge or knowing, basically to know before. I mean, it means the same thing in Greek as it does in English. It doesn't help us understand the meaning of the word in any way. It's just a literal translation for what it means. However, I think that our application of the word differs from how Paul had originally intended it generally, and so I wanted to look at that a little bit. The word itself simply means to know beforehand, but does not supply what it is being known. That must be found in the context. Many people go on to supply the answer to the question, what is God knowing beforehand, concluding that what God is foreseeing here is faith. You're saying that God knows that we're going to have faith beforehand. According to these people, they continue on in the verse to assume that the reason that God saves people is due to their faith, which God has foreseen. Of course, this is not what the verse actually says. You see, God does not actually know things beforehand, at least not from His perspective. Or as Ben Kenobi would say, at least from a certain point of view. Because He is not bound by time as we are. And that's God, not Ben Kenobi. I don't know if Jedis are bound by time or not, so I'll have to look into that one. God is not bound by time as we are. He sees all events and all things as if they were present. To him, there is no past or future. All things just are. God's omnipresence does not mean that God is everywhere at once. I was always taught that. It sounds kind of right, but it's not. I think that God's presence, or God's omnipresence, does not mean that God is everywhere at once, but rather that he is everywhere at all times. It's kind of an interesting way to look at it. But the more I think about it, and the more I get into philosophical understanding of things, and the more I read Scripture and try to understand the way that God looks at things, I'm more and more convinced that that's the truth. God is everywhere at all times. Foreknowledge, the word foreknowledge, is a human term used to help us understand something. When it is applied to God, it is an anthropomorphic term, if you will. Or an anthropomorphic term would be, it's a term that's used in order to help us understand it the best that we can. Because we're coming from a perspective of finite creatures, trying to understand an infinite creature, and that's impossible. And so God, in his sovereignty, has decided, you know, a lot of times God is speaking to us and explaining things to us in ways that we can understand it best. Because he's explaining things to us that our finite minds can't understand or cannot fathom. If this passage were to be saying that God foresees faith in certain people, the meaning of the verse would be something like this. God knows in advance which people he is going to grant faith, and on this basis he predestines, calls, justifies, and glorifies them. Because we know that faith is a gift of God and not of ourselves, in Ephesians 2:8, and that Christ is the author and the perfecter of our faith, Hebrews 12:2. Faith, therefore, is a work of God in us, not a work wrought by us. In short, therefore, the verse would be saying, because God knew what he was going to do, he did it. That's what that passage would be saying. If foreknowledge was meaning that God was simply foreseeing faith. If we accept this interpretation, the intended meaning of the word foreknow would be lost, and the passage would become somewhat redundant. This particular verse does not say that God is foreseeing all things, and it does not say that God foresees faith, even though that both of these statements are true, in an anthropomorphic sense at least. We must look at the verse and see what it does say. It says, those he foreknew, he also predestined. It says that he foreknows people, and the word faith is not even mentioned, nor is any action. So if we are to look at this verse and understand what it is actually saying, it flows something like this. God has a purpose to save certain people, and he does something about it. And praise be to God for that. His divine foreknowledge is talking about a personal knowledge. For example, in Amos 3:2, the Hebrew equivalent to knowledge, he's using this term in Amos 3:2. God says, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. And this is speaking about an intimate knowledge, as a father knows his children. Not merely knowing of them, but truly knowing them intimately. This sense of knowing should come to mind when reading Romans 8. God set his special love upon us before we even existed. Not because of anything good or bad that we've done, but in order to serve his own purposes, it pleases God to have us as his intimate children. Think about that. It pleases God to have us as his intimate children. It's almost impossible, I think, to ponder that statement and to not feel yourself drawn or compelled to worship. I truly believe that. If you sit there and just say that, that it pleases God to have us as intimate children. And if you know who we are as sinners, and the more you understand how awful our sin is that we have done to God and the things that we've done to God, the more that statement will just blow you away and the more it will compel you to worship. And I think that understanding foreknowledge and understanding the rest of these terms here are very important. And the more we understand them, the more that we're going to be compelled to worship God. The word foreknowledge was actually used 7 different times in the New Testament, or the Greek word is used for the word foreknowledge is used 7 different times. 2 times it was used to refer to different men's foreknowledge, foreknowing a certain act. When we think of the term, we usually think of it just as foreknowing a certain act or an action. It's easier to say that. Because we are finite beings, we actually have the possible of having foreknowledge. I don't think that it's possible for God to have foreknowledge, as I said, because I think that every time to him is present. I don't think there's a past for him. And I'll go on and explain that a little bit more as we get into the rest of the verse. But as finite beings, I mean, foreknowledge that we usually talk about it. You know, you know someone, you know your father really well, and you know that he's coming down into your room, and when he sees your room that it's a mess, he's going to be displeased. You can foreknow that he's going to be displeased, you know, because you know that person, and you know his reaction, and so you can foreknow that. And it's not necessarily a 100% thing, but it's just a general run-of-the-mill use of the word, and that's how we usually think of it. But I think that we need to think of it in a different way when we're thinking about God. And when we're applying terms to God as an infinite being, I think that it becomes a little bit more challenging for us to understand how they should be defined, because he is so different from us. And I think that it's important to understand that. Going on in the verse, I'm not going to spend as much time on the rest of these. For those he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. That statement there as well, if you were to, I could devote two or three sermons to this probably if I wanted to, just to the word predestined. It's one of the most talked about, discussed, debated words and definitions of words, you know, in theology. And you go back 1,200 years and they're arguing about it already. But I think that most of us here have a good understanding of what predestined means. He predestined us to be conformed to the image of his Son. And he predestined us to be conformed to the image of his Son. You know, we're these sinful, awful people. The more you read the Bible, the more you understand we're sinful, awful people. That's who we are. And he predestined us to be conformed to the image of his Son, to be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ. And we're so unworthy of that. And a proper understanding of that would compel you to worship. That he might be the firstborn of many brethren. Moreover, those whom he predestined, he also called. And God called us. This is something else that God has done. Something else that we need to understand. And the more we understand this, how he calls people, the more we're going to understand him and how he works, and the more we're going to feel compelled to worship. Because he's called each and every one of us in here. You know, we've been called by God. And that is a special thing. And the more you understand how special the calling of God is, on our hearts, the more you will feel compelled to worship. Those he called, he also justified. And again, I must reiterate, the more you understand about how sinful you are, the more you understand about justification. You know, the more you understand about justification, the more you will feel compelled to worship. Those whom he justified, he also glorified. And that's an interesting thing here, because it says glorified and it uses the past tense. I need to reiterate that all these things, all these five things, are things that God has done in our salvation. These are things that God has done for us. And so they are sure. And even though we may not be glorified yet in our temporal state, from God's perspective, we already are glorified. Because it's that sure. We can be so sure of our salvation, because our salvation is wrought by God and not by us, that we can be sure that we have already been glorified. That's how sure it is. And also, since God is looking at it outside of time, that's basically, I believe, that's his perspective on it. I believe that our salvation is as good as gold, and I believe that we're as good as in already. We're there with him. We just have to wait, from our perspective, in time, until that happens. But I think a proper understanding of all these things would compel us to worship. Years ago, a man named Harry A. Ironside, who's a great Bible teacher, told a story about an older Christian who was asked to give his testimony. He told how God had sought him out and found him, how God had loved him, a great witness to the grace, power, and the glory of God. But after the meeting, a rather legalistic young brother took him aside and criticized his testimony, as certain ones of us like to do, to criticize other people's testimonies. He said, "I appreciate all that you said about what God did for you, but you didn't mention anything about your part in it. Salvation is really part us and part God. You should have mentioned something about your part." "Oh yes," the older Christian said, "I apologize for that. I'm sorry. I really should have said something about my part. My part was running away, and his part was running after me until he caught me." We've all run away, but God has set his love on us, predestined us to become like Jesus Christ, called us to faith and repentance, justified us, yes, and even glorified us, so certain is his completion of this plan. May He alone be praised. May He alone be worshipped. Because He alone has done in us, as believers, His truly miraculous work of taking our hearts of stone and replacing them with hearts of flesh. He alone has opened our eyes to the truth of His holiness, and His works alone are worthy of all of our worship. And that is the conclusion of my sermon. So, Heavenly Father, I just thank You for this time we could come together and hear these words. And I just ask, Father, that that You would just continue to bless us with Your presence and to help us to continue in this Lord's Day and this day of rest that You have provided for us, Father. And we thank You for this day which You have provided. And I just ask, Father, that You would just continue to bless this congregation. And I ask all these things in the name of Your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.